on this episode.
Coming back to the desert and taking care of my dad and him passing, that was the beginning of a big spiral for me. I knew I was on a slippery slope already. You know when you've used up your quota of drinks in your life and you're using other people's drink tickets because it's borrow time. And you quietly, I think for me, I quietly tried to get a handle on it.
From the coveted corner booth in a little bar in the center of the Coachella Valley universe, welcome to another Big Conversation with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence. Gentlemen.
Howard, thank you very much. We are here at Skip Page's Little Bar, the center of the Coachella Valley universe, for another edition of Big Conversations Little Bar. My name is Patrick Evans, and I'm here with my co-host, Randy Florence.
Thank you for letting me back.
You just had a wonderful experience. You were playing in the Gallery Classic.
No, I was not playing.
Oh, you weren't playing.
I was close to people who were playing.
Okay, you were.
So
you were stalking Fred Couples.
He withdrew.
I know, yeah.
Which was interesting because now that you mention it, it's possible that's the reason why. I'd been telling everybody I was there to see Fred Couples, and he withdrew.
So that was a fun experience.
It was such a blast. I mean, Saturday and Sunday in the desert. Whenever we're recording this, I mean, it could be January through November. I don't know exactly. I'm saying that for John's benefit. It was not a good weather weekend, and I really knew it wasn't going to be coming in because you left town.
Oh, yeah.
And
no,
the local meteorologist generally gets out of Dodge.
Absolutely.
When he sees bad weather coming
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely. For good cause, for good reason. No, that particular weekend was the Gallery Classic, so you had all of these champions coming in, and then it was also the White Party, and all they want to do is be in the pool. You know, that's the whole point of the weekend, the dancing and the pool. And it was going to rain and be cold, so I did not want to be
anywhere. It rained hard, though, so the pool might have been drier.
It was
a bad day.
Well, that's a cool experience to be out there. You were marshaling.
I was marshaling. My job was to stand on the greens and keep the people from causing any ruckus, the galleries. And I think the biggest gallery I saw in 3 days because of the weather was maybe five people. I didn't have to tackle anybody or anything.
And in Rancho Mirage, I believe the average age is 90.
Yes. And I did feel very young. really young.
Were they really worried about that gallery getting out of hand? I mean, they thought...
Well, if they were bringing somebody like me in to solve it, no, they obviously weren't worried about it. There was literally not one person in there that I would have been able to take down if anything had gone wrong.
Well, what a cool experience.
It was.
You know, I am really excited about today's guest. And I'll give you a little inside baseball. She is the most often booked guest
on this show.
Conversations Little Bar.
Yes.
We have booked her multiple times.
On average, every 20 shows.
Every 20 shows we have booked.
We've booked
Lisa Lynn Morgan. And she has found multiple experiences, excuses not to come in. So she forced yourself into a car wreck the last time.
Guys, I just got a call. I got to go.
Thank you very much for persevering.
Thanks for the drink. We had a great conversation before.
I hope we can remember some of it. It was really good.
So thank you very much for coming in. When we first started talking about guests and who we should have on, you were right at the top of my list because I've always enjoyed your performances, and I've gotten to see you wear lots of different hats. You were doing marketing for Big Rock Pub, and now you are publishing Joshua Tree Voice along with our buddy Ray Rodriguez.
Yes, and that's been a big job. I do some marketing under the banner of Little Big Voice, which is something I created, trying to reinvent myself during COVID, hoping to help smaller businesses, keep on track with their marketing in a really difficult time with no overhead,
And
I'm cheap.
You have one of the greatest bands, the Broken Hallelujahs.
I do. I'm not going to shy away from that because the musicians that I get to play with are outstanding, and I'm just working really hard not to be the weak link right there.
Yeah. I want to start with the band and your singing and your performing career because that's how I originally got to know you. So tell us a little bit about your background in performance and how you got this particular group of musicians. I know that they're kind of different iterations of the band. You can do it big or you can do it smaller, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was born and raised here, and born at Desert Hospital, and grew up in Rancho Mirage back when it was, I think it was Cathedral City before it was Rancho Mirage, right? I'm dating myself. And I've always been involved in theater or dance or music of some sort, but...
Your first public performance at 11?
Yes.
There was a very special guest
yes.
that heard you sing.
Somebody did research. Well, you've had plenty of opportunities, like three or something.
He told me this story, and it's been so long that I've forgotten, so I'm looking forward to hearing.
Well, it was back when Mama Sinatra was alive, and I was going to... St. Louis Church, that was our diocesan Catholic church that we went to. So I was involved in the choir, and they were becoming a little more contemporary. It wasn't just the standard Catholic hymns. They had me singing The Little Drummer Boy, which was my favorite song ever. And so we did traditional music, and then we did The Little Drummer Boy, and I'm 11-ish. And I sing it. And I don't think anybody's listening because everybody in, you know, the church is very, you know, quiet.
No standing ovation or anything.
Nobody's misbehaving there. They don't need you to keep them in line, like in golf.
No marshals.
And so I sang it, and then afterwards, you know, we're kind of, the choir is just standing by the door, and I'm just standing there. I'm way younger than everybody else, and my stepmom is a second-generation Catholic Sicilian. In love with Frank Sinatra. And all of a sudden this gentleman comes up to me and he walks up and he pats me on the cheek like, keep singing from the heart, kid. And I'm like, thank you, sir. You
know, Frank Sinatra.
And my stepmother is just about to fall to pieces. And I'm like, I have no idea. Did I do something wrong? I had no idea what happened. And they later told me that that was Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
Isn't that cool?
That's just the coolest story.
Yeah. Well, and growing up out here, especially right there, I was lodged in a little track housing. I don't know. You know, I grew up blue collar out here. My dad worked for General Telephone, which is now Verizon. And was an engineer, and we lived in the track housing that was set up basically to be part-time housing. We were there full-time, and that's right. It's still there, off of Duval and Cobb Road. We had Red Skelton within a bike ride's distance. We had Frank Sinatra, and so we hit Harpo Marx's house was out there, and so there, those are the places we hit at Halloween. You know, hoping for the big candy bars.
Were there good? Was it pretty good?
Frank Sinatra had his gate person handing out candy, and that it was good. Yeah, but my favorite was Red Skelton because he was out there in person.
Yeah,
and he had these little prepared bags of candy, and it was when he had his variety show on television, and so I went up there. I love your show, Mr. Skelton. Mm. And he reached into his pocket, pulled out a silver dollar, and put it in my bag.
That's a cool story.
Those are the kind of things, you know, in that
the
I
desert.
Think are unique to grow up out here.
I've
Nobody else wanted to grow up out here.
I've seen this amazing picture of the Coachella Valley Orchestra out in the desert in front of a giant sand dune being led by Red Skelton.
That's a beautiful picture.
It's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, Frank could not be out, like, handing out candy. Because every time he was around 10 or more kids, you had to sing Pocket Full of Miracles, and Frank didn't want to do that song.
Well, that and my stepmother would have mauled him.
That's right. So you grew up out here, sang in the choir. When did you decide that you wanted to do what you're doing now with the Broken Hallelujahs in fronting a band? And
well, I had sung in musical theater. I'd sang in Vegas. I'd been the kind of the token girl singer, because in Vegas you have to have a girl singer. She doesn't necessarily have to be up front. We had a great front man, and I love singing harmonies, and you know, that was my experience, so I was happy to do that. And I did so pretty successfully until I decided I didn't want to die a lounge lizard. And
it's my lifelong dream.
It didn't really work with, you know, being close kids. You know, it was like a night schedule, and it wasn't working. And so I came back to Southern California after Vegas, and didn't care if I ever sang at all. again. But when my dad was diagnosed with cancer and he was living here, I came out to spend some time with him, and my roots just kind of slowly just grew back, because at that point I had traveled all over. I had lived in Chakota, Oklahoma. I'd live in Antlers, Oklahoma. I lived in Paris, Texas, McKinney, Texas, North Carolina.
What were you doing in these places?
My first marriage, we were in the military. So we were stationed at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And then at one point in my life, I was in California, but, you know, the housing crisis happened. I was living in Simi Valley, right next door to Countrywide, and got laid off from a job in middle management for Tire Pros, which is now pretty much America's Tire in marketing. And so I had friends who had moved to all these places, and they're all, oh, come, everything's cheap. It's like, yeah. And I went and tried it a couple of times, got chewed up and spit out. You know, it just never worked for me. Although I do have great memories of being that waitress in Chakota, Oklahoma, where the farmers would come in, and you're serving them coffee, and then they come in later, and they're having, you know, supper. And it was simple, and it was good, and it was like living all those country songs that I'd always loved singing. And then coming back to California to take care of my dad and spend those last years with him, the roots came back. And I knew at that point, there is no more beautiful place to live when you take all the pluses and minuses than this desert.
100% agree.
Because the amount of beauty and the cost of the heat, and yeah, maybe there's earthquakes, but I'll take an earthquake any day over 3 days of circulation and storm warnings.
Yeah.
Where, you know, at the end of the storm or whatever, you have to collect your things from other neighbors. And, you know, earthquake, it's all in one place. It's over. I'm going to deal with whatever's going to happen, you know. So that's kind of where I'm at. You know, knock on wood, we don't have to deal with that. But it's just so beautiful here. I appreciated it when I was younger, but not until I could compare it to other places. Yeah. So coming back here, I didn't think I would sing.
Were you doing anything musically at that point?
I wasn't doing anything musically other than singing karaoke. I was kind of the drunk waitress, bartender, singing a song at karaoke, and eventually, you know, my father passed, and I had to come to terms with my own issues with alcohol, and that was about 12 and a half years ago, and fortunately found sobriety and a way of living that was productive, and I never imagined that I'd be singing again. But I had been asked to put together a country band by a friend who is running Jackalope. Jackalope. And Friday nights. So I pulled together some friends. I'd been writing for CV Weekly, so I knew all the musicians. And I'd sung with a couple of groups like Arbuckle Road, and I sang with doing in duos here and there, just a mishmash. And when he asked me to put a band together, that was the first time I'd ever even considered fronting a band and
really?
Doing all the things, hiring the musicians, handling the money, getting the promotions, you know, booking the gigs. And that was maybe 7 years ago.
Wow.
8 years ago. It's hard to say.
Because it seems like forever
It feels natural now, but there was a huge learning curve. And, you know, it's a small business. You're running a business and other people are depending on you.
Yeah.
And it's been a huge growth. I feel like through it, I'm finding my voice in more ways than one, but definitely vocally, but also as a human being, not being afraid of things anymore.
Where are your standing gigs?
We are at Cazuela's Cafe every Wednesday at 6 p.m., and then every third Thursday, we are at Shanghai Reds in Palm Springs. Both of those are such good supporters of live music.
Good old Lou Picano.
Yes, and they feed us. So, like, in both places have tacos. So, like, can it get better? Can it get better? Tacos, and I get to do music. So it's good work if you can get it. I suggest everybody go home. Get their friends together. Start a band. Just do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Randy's all in.
You don't have to tell me twice.
He was Captain
Slick.
Slick.
Let's get it right.
And the band was
the Stick Shifts.
Yeah.
Captain Slick and his Stick Shifts.
I love that.
Isn't that awesome?
I have all their albums.
There's so many ways to say that wrong.
Yes. And I very often did. Couldn't drink before I sang.
Let's go back and talk about your journey to sobriety, because we were having this conversation before we started rolling, and you were telling a really, fascinating and difficult story.
Well, it was difficult then. Now it's, I feel like it's important to share because I wanted to give hope to people, encouragement for when they're ready, they know that there's something you can do. But for me, coming back to the desert and taking care of my dad and him passing, that was the beginning of a big spiral for me. I knew I was on a slippery slope already. You know when you've used up your quota of drinks in your life and you're using other people's drink tickets because it's borrowed time. And you quietly, I think for me, I quietly tried to get a handle on it without getting the stigma of being called an alcoholic or having to confess that. It was a real source of shame, and it was very isolating.
And initially, were you taking the approach that you could fix it yourself?
Yes. Oh. Yeah, well, I had to, because who was I going to tell? Mm-hmm. I was ashamed of it. Something had gotten control of me, and I'd never looked kindly on other people who were out of control. I was very judgmental, so why wouldn't I judge myself? Eventually, it just got to a point where being prone to depression, coming from a family of dysfunction, generations of dysfunction, I did not have the tool set, the equipment to figure anything out, and all I could tell was I was just a huge failure at life. And it culminated to I just was praying not to wake up anymore, and I just couldn't find my way out of this dark hole. There was no hope. The deadly combination is helplessness and hopelessness. You have an addiction that you have no control over as hard as you tried, and then you don't even know how to help yourself. So it's a dark, dark place. And I decided I was going to just keep drinking until I didn't wake up. It was on purpose. It was cowardly. It was the easiest way I knew how to do it. But I really didn't want to wake up. And so I drank everything I could get my hands on. And apparently, somewhere out there, a higher power said no. Because as much as I've drank in my career of drinking, nothing would stay down. And I could feel myself. I'd already put myself through 3 days of detox. Every time I would, drink, and then it would get a hold of me, and then I'd stop. And then 3 days, I'm shaky. I'm not feeling well. I'm dizzy. I'm kind of out of it. And then by the fourth day, I'm good. So at one point in this episode where I'm trying purposely not to wake up, I realized I wasn't able to keep anything down, and I could feel myself already going into detox, the DTs. And I was like, okay, great. Well, here we go, 3 days. 3 days later, I wasn't doing so good. This was worse than before. I got scared. I picked up a phone and called 911. And I'd never asked for help before, ever, so I was pretty scared. I was brought to the emergency room over there at Eisenhower, and they were really wonderful there. But my heart rate was about to go into a cardiac arrest. So there's a thing that they do where they inject your IV and it slows your heart down, kind of like hitting restart on a computer. And so I could feel my heart, just so I wouldn't go into BFib, because I feel my heart just slowing down. And it's a very freaky feeling. I could feel like the essence of life was being kind of siphoned through the back of my shoulder blades. And they tell you to stay calm while this is happening, and they only want to do it once, but it feels like there's a fireman's knee in your chest, and that it'll go away, it'll subside. But during that time, I just closed my eyes, and I prayed to the God that I understood, help me. I'm not sure I want this to happen. And there was an actual conversation in my mind's eye of, we can walk to the end of this cliff, and we can jump. You've been asking not to wake up. We could do this right here. And I did feel like I had some control over that, at least in that moment. And then I could feel my heart come in. I'm like, no, 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 no. And then my heart would come back. They ended up having to do this procedure 3 times. 1 time was risky. And 3 times, the same kind of thoughtful prayer, and I think visually. So it's not like I'm having like a supernatural vision or I'm seeing a light at the end of the tunnel. It's just a real honest conversation with a higher power, my higher power. And I'm walking to the edge of that cliff and realizing I don't want to jump off this cliff. I do want to live. I just don't want to keep living like this. I've got to find a better way. And when I was released from the hospital, I called central office from a list of numbers that the hospital gave me and went to my first meeting.
Central office is Alcoholics Anonymous.
It's a secret club. Yes. It's anonymous. But I qualified. So, you know, it's one of the first clubs I qualified for. Yeah. And I got in.
Membership.
Membership is I don't want to drink anymore. And I want to learn how to live without drinking. That eventually... You know, I think my most honest prayer with God was, I don't know how to live, and you're going to have to show me, because I've thrown everything I know at this. And long story short, I just asked God to not put anything in front of me that I couldn't say yes to, because I realized my decision-making was kind of off. And
you told us the story, you started to tell us the story of the very first meeting you went to.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope to sit in a big room in the back and just kind of get acclimated, right? And nobody's going to see me. I'm just going to hide out back here. I was a mess. After what I put my body through, I could barely speak, much less think about singing again. But it was a small meeting. It was 8 people big. I had to read. I had to participate. I had to socialize. And when it came around to me to read, the big book opened up to Bill's story. And... y'all can Google this to get more information about it, and I hope you do, because I think what Bill and Dr. Bob developed is a 12-step program that gave me tools for a toolbox that was empty. And anyway, so I had to read this part out of that book, and it just fell to me, and it was, and I was released from the hospital and was scared sober for a bit. After what I put myself through, I knew I could. That scared me to death. I can't be sober for a bit. I gotta be sober or I die. I drink,
this has
I die.
To take. We're not experimenting with sobriety.
Right.
Yes.
We're committed to it.
Yeah. So I think when you get to that place of being willing to do whatever it takes, and it's not like, well, I'll do this, but I won't do that. I think you become open to all the good things coming in that you need. And, you know, my hope is after 12 and a half years that my sobriety is the kind of quality sobriety that will shine a light on how great sobriety can be. I didn't have to quit singing. I worked in bars. I had to cover bands in bars and write about them.
You're sitting in a bar right now?
I'm in a bar right now drinking a fojito.
Fojito.
With blueberries, and it's delicious.
You were telling us when you kind of reached that point, you did get help from a number of sources. One of those sources was House of Hope.
Yes.
This is run by the Seroptimist Club.
Yes, in Desert Hot Springs. At that point, I had about a month of sobriety, and I had gotten a sponsor, and I'm in the meetings, and I'm feeling like, I got this. But at the same time, I was calling because I was told to. It was suggested to me by my sponsor, call for a bed. I didn't have the resources to pay for anything or insurance. So you have to call in for a bed. There was a couple of places, and you call in every day, and... I got the call that they had a bed for me, and I'm like, do I really have to go away for 45 days and live with other people that I don't know in this most uncomfortable of imagined scenarios? Because I got this, I'm good. But then I remembered I made a commitment to say yes, and I kept that willingness. And I didn't even know what I needed for myself at that point, but you think you do. But in retrospect, 45 days of being able to focus on just what it means to be sober and how to build brick by brick, not just a sober life, but a quality sobriety with the basics, the fundamentals of sobriety, without the interactions of husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, kids that are kind of pulling you out in different directions when you're really raw.
Yeah.
And it was a gift that I didn't realize how much I needed. And it allowed me to have a solid foundation in sobriety. That and the grace of God, because I can't ever take it for granted.
You talked a little bit about the groundlessness of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Alcohol became the addiction of choice for you somewhere in your life. were there times as you were growing up that you can look back and say, I can see where the seeds of it started?
Yeah, I would say I was the alcoholic personality from birth. You know, whatever led to that, but it was I think sometimes we can diagnose ourselves in two areas. I'm dependent, and then I'm codependent. And one is kind of self-medicating the other. I battled with depression. In the beginning, alcohol helped my depression. It was a sugar rush, and I was the funnest person in the bar. And until I wasn't. I would go home crying.
But I do have to say today, you still are. You're the funnest person in this bar.
I'm gonna apologize to the people right behind you because they look pretty fun. But I'm grateful to be here and be able to share this story. Because I really want people to understand that, you know, get rid of the stigma, the shame. It happens. You know, it happens. And there's generations before us that may have led us here. There's so many things, so many reasons to want to kind of disappear from this dysfunctional world. Yeah. And trying to survive that, using our survival instincts, isn't always healthy. And finding some new ones, whether you're an alcoholic or not, I still feel like the principles, the 12 steps principles, fill in the blank. If it's alcohol, if it's drugs, if it's workaholic, if it's, you know, people pleasing, whatever it is that's making your life unmanageable, you can fill in that blank, connect to a higher power that you feel you can connect to, whatever that is. And I think there's hope in that for anybody who desperately wants to apply that. It's just, it's magic. And it keeps getting better.
Well, it's stories like yours that need to continue to be heard because people do think, 3 days is too much. How am I going to get through this? So they need to know that people can do it.
Yeah.
Thank you for that, and congratulations on 12 and a half years.
Thank you.
That's really fantastic.
It's a remarkable story. Appreciate you sharing it. And I know that's kind of part of the idea, is that you share that story to help others.
Yeah, you give it away to keep it. Yeah. And I think that works in a lot of different areas. You know, when we give charitably to others, it's a life hack. How much you get back. And you know that. I see you doing this all the time. I mean, I've seen you at several House of Hope functions supporting them, and I'm grateful for that. But yeah,
and this is a geography that lends itself to it if you want to be a giver.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's plenty of opportunities here.
No shortage of places to give, to help people, you know, in so many different places. You know, there's so many charities here in the Valley that focus on dependency and substance abuse, but, you know, maybe that's not your thing. You know, there are pet charities galore, kids charities.
Homeless charities,
you know, but really important places. You know, this is a weird place that we live because literally the richest men in the world live here part of the time, and they live within a 20-minute drive of the poorest people, perhaps in the entire country, you know. So it's this remarkable dichotomy, and I saw that when I first moved to the Valley, and I thought, maybe they get it because it is one of the most giving places. Maybe they realize here you can see the need, because the contrast is so great.
Yeah. Now
you see Randy's mansion, and then you...
I'm waiting to see it.
I'm giggling at your face. I'm shocked.
I'm really looking forward to seeing my mansion. Well, that's only because my last house was 400 square feet, so this 900 square feet is huge. Yeah, it's really big.
So, that's called a casita.
That's right.
It's quiet. They're not allowed to rent out the casitas to me.
So, but then once you got good footing, you were grounded again, you found your voice in singing again.
Yeah. I even did that audition at the Morongo Valley, the casino. They had the voice there.
Yeah.
And I scariest thing I ever did.
Really?
But I'm glad I did it, because now I know I can do scary things, you know? But, so I waited in the hallway to go in and just sing a cappella for a producer. Got the golden ticket. For the first round. Second one, they were going to email us, but never got further than that. I'm just proud that I did it.
That's really cool.
It was a big day to sit there and just wait and kind of watch all the atmosphere. And You know, I have part of my issue is just clear confidence, you know. So I love how this program has helped me pay attention to my character defects and own my part in things, and then get to learn and grow through it. It's a maintenance program. It's about taking care of your soul, your heart, and getting your head out of your, can I say it?
Yes. Yes, you
ass.
Can.
Ass? Yeah, it's, you know, that sound.
It's one of the.
That's your head coming out of your ass, and it's a great sound.
I love sound effects on podcasts. That was important.
The view gets so much better. But, yeah, it's just, we're broken individuals, and I think, if you can find something that can help you stay on track and keep moving forward and how to manage stress, like pandemics. I was single through the whole pandemic. I'm still single. And that's a first. Just learning to navigate and take care of myself and not expect someone else to come in and rescue me.
Let's talk about that. That, for people on stage, public-facing people, that was a pretty bizarre time for you. How did you get through it?
Well, it was hard on a couple of levels because, I was let go. It's the only thing that made sense. You know, I was in charge of marketing and entertainment.
At Big Rock Pub. And
basically, I'm the chief gatherer.
Right.
And there was no gathering.
That's right.
Yeah, I get it. Bye. I had a sponsor, and I realized that it was important for me to say. I also have a sponsee, which is a magical thing because anything I tell my sponsee, the girl I sponsor, I know I'm supposed to be listening to. Like, it's such a reciprocal relationship.
It's,
that mentorship is huge. And we got each other through it, all of us. And there were, AA meetings online or outside. But the biggest part was just feeling lost and alone. And is the world, what's happening? Is it getting worse? Is it going to get better? It seems like it's getting worse. And then no music. And the doing the live streams was good, but it was hard for me to be motivated because my whole thing about singing is engaging, like what we're doing here, or connecting to somebody and making that mood change. That's the good feeling that comes from entertaining, is making things, lifting people up, either making them cry or whatever. It's cathartic.
Yeah.
And it's hard to do that with a screen.
It also, for non-performers who go and see live music, it's the communal experience. You can listen to any song you want at any point with today's technology, but it's not about just listening to that song. It's listening to that song and experiencing it with other people.
Yeah.
It's like why we still like to go to movies, because the whole, hundred of you in the theater are experiencing the same emotions, and that's why I love live music performances.
Yeah.
And it was such a detriment that we were not able to do that, and you're right. It doesn't translate via Zoom. The same way.
It killed Captain Slick and the Stick Shifts. We never recovered from that.
You guys were performing regularly prior to the pandemic?
Well, not since 1975, but we were anticipating a big comeback.
So really, the Carter administration killed
He killed us.
Okay.
Don't blame Jimmy.
I'm not blaming
Stop
Jimmy.
Blaming
no,
Jimmy.
I'm sure it was Ford.
It was Ford.
It was
Ford killed the band.
Ford.
And New York.
But, let's whip inflation now.
As you go ahead, I'm sorry.
To your point, when we did finally come back, and it was Caswell's Cafe that supported us coming back, along with a lot of other musicians, because they have that big outdoor patio.
Yeah, they needed that.
When the government decided that we weren't projectile killers. As musicians and
my
singers,
spit will kill you.
Everybody had a comeback plan. The salons, the everybody,
yeah.
Except for musicians. Nope, you're a projectile spitter. You're gonna get everybody sick. Like, no, I want.
Did you notice me backing up here? As she was
I'm like, but yeah, there were people crying. And 6 months later, after everything opened up, some people took longer to feel like they could venture back. 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, they were like, this is the first time we've been in live music and it feels so good. And that's when we knew, if we didn't already, how important what we were able to give was.
What was the first live performance after the pandemic for you guys?
It was at Caswell's Cafe.
Yeah. And how did
that
feel?
There was a line out the door.
Yeah, I remember.
On a weeknight. And you know, it was a beautiful time. I'm so glad you brought it up because it's really good to remember those times, the comeback times, right? And people still love live music. But, you know, we're kind of back into the flow of taking things for granted.
Yeah, it I think we're pretty fully post-pandemic now. And although, you know, you still see people wearing masks from time to time. And some people are still really cautious about going out in big crowds.
Measles. Yeah.
That's the next play. The one you thought we'd whipped.
That's right.
Is this the part you edit out? Okay.
This is.
You will not hear my voice for approximately 45 minutes.
A lot of stuff out. It's heavily edited.
The coolest thing we got to do during the pandemic, and it was not too far into it, we had, remember when Eisenhower was all lit up to support the first responders and the caregivers?
Yeah.
Myself and Bobby Fergo, who plays keys and fiddle, Bobby Fergo toured with the late, great Leonard Cohen, and he's on those albums.
Wow.
Hallelujah, that's Bobby Fergo.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was in my band. Now he's too busy for me, but that's okay, because I still love him, and that's the reason we're called the Broken Hallelujahs, is Bobby Fergo said, hey, how about Lisa Lynn and the Broken Hallelujahs from the song we did night after night, because we had him, you know? We did that song on Town Center Parkway. They shut down the street. They started at Eisenhower, and they did a thing there for all the caregivers, who I still think are heroes to this day.
Yep.
And then they traveled down to Town Center Parkway in front of the car wash right there. And Bob, just me and Bobby, wearing masks outside because we didn't know what.
Well, that projectile, you know. Well, right.
I don't know. I had my iPad going so we could film it, and maybe it would, like, get on that. I don't know. But we did whatever we had to do to make everybody comfortable, and we just didn't know. We had no information. And so all there's a bunch of police cars, sheriff's cars, and fire trucks that all came down with their sirens going, and then they lined up and parked all down the street. And we had the PA there, and it was pretty, like, I don't even know how I got through it. It was an emotional moment.
Sure.
And it felt like the
moment.
Biggest moment of anything I'd ever done as far as music goes, because these were the people who are out there in the middle of all this I don't know, and I'm risking something that I've already been risking a lot, but now there's this other thing and the whole way to manage it and handle it. So we sang Hallelujah to them, and I still feel really honored and proud that we did that, and that it meant something, you know, at that time. And it was just really cool. And those moments, some of the best moments you don't get unless you're in some kind of peril, or you don't have those comeback stories.
Well, it's
without
like
without the downtime. And I just want to say, my personal experience, every time I crashed and burned, there's always been something right around the corner just waiting for me to just keep doing the next right thing till I get to it. And I just want to encourage anybody who listens to this that moment of coming out of that darkness is always there on one level or another.
No, the old saying is the peaks can only be as high as the depth of the valley.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to go through those to enjoy the peaks and get to them, which you clearly have done. I love the name of the band. And it's nice to know the backstory, because I didn't know that.
Yeah. It doesn't work for, like, the marquees, because it's just too freaking long, but that's okay.
Yeah, the T-shirt, the name comes around the front at the end of it. So.
Yeah. Only in the XXX, yeah, it might have room.
So, but you guys do a great deal of work, you know, performing, but also doing some charity work as well.
It always feels wrong to call being able to perform and make music for charity, because it's such a rewarding thing. You know, you get paid,
yeah,
one way or another. And that's, I think, all the musicians out here. I would have to say that Coachella Valley and High Desert musicians they are the first ones in line if you give them a call and you give them an invitation to show up and show up in full force with their whole hearts, and they don't half-ass it at all. They give everything when they have these opportunities to raise money and take care of this community.
I'm really glad you just brought up the High Desert, because you've been working on a project that I know is a passion project for you, and that's Joshua Tree Voice, which you started publishing how long ago?
We're in our third year of publishing. It'll be 3 years in October.
Has it been that long?
Yeah.
Because you and Ray came on Eye on the Desert to kind of talk about.
And thank you for that, yes.
Oh, of course. I can't believe that's 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a kind of interesting how that happened. Pappy and Harriet's and Have a Pioneer Town all sold in the same day, two different escrows. And being tied in the community through music, I ran open mic up there at Pappy and Harriet's before it sold and before COVID came around and kind of shut everything down. And I've always loved that community, and it's given me a lot. There's something in the earth. It just comes out of the earth.
There's a vortex there. There's no doubt about
it. Yeah, and for creatives, I think that's, you know, fueling. But anyway, so I realized that the communities were a little bit panicked because everything was changing. Airbnbs were flooding, and people were coming in from LA, and there were bumper stickers. Nothing, not that I'm proud of, but, you know, go back to LA. So, and then, like, was it Miley Cyrus who was up in a Joshua tree and got in big trouble because it's an endangered,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, they need a voice. You know, they need a voice to say, hey, this is what I'm worried about, and here's a possible solution. Or to just cover the stories, or like the creative artwork and the beautiful things that are happening from the creatives. They didn't have anybody really covering that.
No. It's very, you know, ostensibly it's part of our market. The TV station tries to, it's hard. But also, during the pandemic, there was that influx of people fleeing cities, and mm-hmm. you know, but there was a lot of good influx because a lot of the artists started taking up residence in the High Desert.
Yeah.
And so there was this influx of, the nuts and the idiots, but also this incredible influx of talent.
Yeah, and quite honestly, unless you're indigenous to the land, you know, which even I'm not, and I was born here in 1966. We all moved here. You know, we're all travelers here. I think the part that was difficult was people not understanding the culture of the High Desert. And people had invested their livelihoods and their homes to live in this solace with dark skies where you can see the stars. And that was getting trampled on occasions, more than people like to admit. Rocks were being painted on. You know, trash was litter. It's still an issue. It wasn't just an issue in COVID, but it was a bigger issue during COVID because, the park struggled during that time. So I was doing some marketing for Ray Rodriguez over at Cazuelas Cafe in Corktree, and we were having a meeting about some marketing things, and I just said, Joshua Tree needs a magazine like Coachella Valley Weekly. And I've worked really close with Coachella Valley Weekly and Tracy Dietlin. And I saw what she was able to do for the musicians and what how she brought them forward in a publication that, you know, they might not have been seen or heard otherwise. So I thought about writing for Joshua Tree and CV Weekly, but there's only so much bandwidth in pages. So when I mentioned to Ray that, man, they need their own publication, he got up out of his chair, stood up, he's all, let's do this. Like, it just struck a chord with him. And my immediate reaction was, oh, shit.
Uh-oh, now I have to
now
do
I've
something.
Done it.
Oh, crap. I'm not kidding. It was like, what? We're going to do what? Because he was so, like, because he loves the area, too. Yeah. He's always
when Ray tells you
this.
To do something, it's going to get done.
Well, and it was real.
Yeah.
You know, he put everything behind it. And I've written. I had connections, personal connections, real connections with people in the area, and I researched it. I talked to people like, "What would you want? What do you think?" And we have an advisory board that has Barnett English, who runs the Joshua Tree Music Festival. We have people from the Joshua Tree National Park Association. We have people from Rancho de la Luna recording, you know. So it, we have people that have been there for a long time as our advisory council, kind of to let us know if we're, you know, going too far left or right, if, you know, suggesting stories or, you know, things that we could do. And I was nervous because I was watching, especially during COVID, you know, there's something involved in social media where it was just okay to bash the crap out of everybody like you wouldn't if you were face to face. And fear does that. Fear makes people want to vent. And I thought for sure we'd be getting like a lot of criticism and a lot of pushback because we were doing something new and we were doing it the best we could based on my instincts and Ray's instincts. And I have to say that that community has absolutely put their arms around this. And if they hadn't, this is hard. It's a hard project. I've never worked harder, but it's purposeful and it matters. And as long as that is happening, we'll continue to put 9 publications out a year. And celebrate the art, the music, the culture, and the ecology. People doing the good work to clean up the deserts and to, you know, preserve and teach.
When you were growing up in the area, was the Joshua Tree area important to you?
It was someplace we would always go with family, and it was always, you know, we didn't travel a lot. We didn't have a lot of money growing up, so. The staycation thing, we were staycationing before it was cool.
Before the term was invented.
Right. Trend. And, you know, the Painted Canyon, Ladder Canyon, and stuff like that. We would go everywhere. And those were the places that were the most magic, you know, the being out under the stars, learning about the Cholla cactus the hard way, and, you know.
Hopefully not twice.
No, not ever twice. Yeah. It had always been, but not nearly as much as when I was an adult and an artist. Finding solace from working down here, working really hard, and then going up there and just feeling like all my scales fell off, and I had feathers instead. It had that effect on my feeling. Like, I'm working, and I've got my armor on, and then I go up there, and I'm just like, fly be free, you know? Oh. And that's how it affected me, and so that love... I think a lot of people feel that love. And so we're doing our best to share that love and teach people.
It is.
How to treat the culture and be part of, as opposed to stomp through.
Yeah. Right. And that's, I think, very important. I mean, I love what you guys are doing there because it is such a distinct culture. The high desert and the low desert are very different places. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think some of these people who just blew in from L.A. thought, oh, I've been to Palm Springs. This is going to be cool. Just going to be, you know, a little more remote. It's not at all the same place. And yeah. The arts culture is different. And I think it thrives up in the high desert in some ways that it doesn't necessarily down here.
Well, what you're seeing, too, is a kind of a mass exodus of artists from down here going back up there.
Yeah.
Mario Lali and a lot of the desert rock bands. They grew up out here in the low desert. But you know what the high desert is right now? It's this place here in the Coachella Valley before Operation Pave the Desert. Mm. It's got that same feeling, that same creative
right.
vibe. And so that's why you see them, they're just kind of retreating up there. John Garcia is up there, Mario Lali.
There's some recording studios up there now.
A bunch of them. Rancho de la Luna was there when there was nothing out there, and they were making music, you know. Dave Grohl loves to go there. Queens of the Stone Age. Arctic Monkeys.
How worried are the people there about the changes that are taking place in the high desert right now?
I think their concern is about people coming in and not respecting the culture. People have big plans and they think that it's the wild, wild west, so there's no accountability. The county, San Bernardino County, is a little bit removed from places like Pioneer Town, and so they have their development overlays that don't necessarily apply to Pioneer Town. And so, but there's brilliant people up there. There are brilliant minds up there. And I think people would be surprised to know how many architects are there doing the due diligence to protect things so that they grow but in a way that protects the vibe and the environment.
It is a place that needs to be protected.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it is so unique. The geology, the ecology, the environment there, but also the culture and the people who have been there for a very long time. So I love Joshua Tree Voice because you guys are doing just that. You're giving a voice to those people who often are not heard down here in the desert.
Cool. Yeah, and that's the hope. That's the hope, to celebrate the hard work that they're doing that might not otherwise be seen. It's a long stretch of highway with a lot of gateway communities. You've got Landers, you've got 29 Palms, and then you've got Pioneer Town, and you've got Yucca Valley, you've got Joshua Tree proper, and all the
Morongo
streets
Valley.
Morongo Valley. They all the streets that go off the 62, and they're all creating. And they're all community, and there's children and kids going to schools, and unfortunately, there's a lot of all the kids in the area qualify for subsidized lunches, and the few that don't are on subsidized lunches just so that they don't stand out. So there's a lot of need out there as well. So there's a lot of work to do up there, a lot of good things that can be done. I know Ray has worked with the Boys Club down here, and he's also worked with the Boys and Girls Club up there as well. There's just a lot of good things that we can do as when we pull people together and pour love into a community, into each other.
One of the things I really loved, and I was looking at it again today, but on the website, in your section that discusses what you guys are about, I love how you wrote about Ray and he wrote about you.
Yeah.
It that was, you know, every bit of that was talked about. You know, every conversation I've ever had with Ray was about marketing. So how are we going to introduce ourselves? And you know, Raymond Rodriguez, he grew up with people in his living room. His dad published a newspaper, you know, publishing a newspaper for the labor and you know, some famous people in his living room. This has always been part.
Cesar Chavez.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And this is something that I think Ray is taking second generation now. And, you know, he writes in there too. And his heart is just always about making things better and leaving a footprint. And he's one of the most giving people I've ever met. And also very wise. So I could not have asked for a better business mentor as well as a partner, because the same goal is to do good things. When he talks about the patio that he built, he told his staff, this is not a place where we're going to gather a bunch of diners and sell dinner tickets. This is going to be a place where we're going to cultivate good.
And that's, community.
That's the theory underneath it.
Yeah.
So purpose in what you're doing. I think that's the goal.
So what's next for you, the Broken Hallelujahs? What's coming up?
Summer.
So I'll see you all in November. Yeah. Bye.
Yeah. We'll be the broke ass hallelujahs. Yeah. We lose half of our... That better? I lost my headset.
We'll edit that out.
Much okay. Better on your head. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's like I'm like trying to fix it, but then the hat. Yeah. So.
Summer's got to be really tough for.
It is everything. You know, I think most of the people here who are working and living here full time, look at summer as something you know, just go into conservation mode. If you can.
It's very different than it was like 22 years ago when I moved to the valley. Most of it was shut down for June, July, and August.
Yeah.
Now, that's not true. There's a lot more year-round.
Well, and
but it's still 120.
That's okay.
I just wanted to mention that.
Even before...
not that
it's
often.
It's the filter. Otherwise, everybody would live here.
That's right.
Everybody.
That's the litmus test. If you can handle it, you can
go
stay.
Back to L.A.
You know, back to your point about the high desert, people come in and they, you know, they are fascinated and maybe romanced by the idea of desert living. My favorite quote about that is, the Mojave chooses. Like, there's people who came in 2020 and then they're gone now. And they're kind of kicking rocks like, it wasn't great as I thought it would be. And it's like, the Mojave chooses.
Yeah.
And if you love the desert, the desert loves you back.
Yeah.
And there's a line, and it costs you 122 degrees. My hottest gig with the Broken Hallelujahs, granted, my band, the average age is 60. And so we were
kids out here in the desert.
They are.
The 4th of July at Agua Caliente, we were so stoked. Like, we got the casino gig. We're gonna play 4th of July. There's going to be 3,000 people in that parking lot. There's going to be record temperatures on the pavement. That part we weren't so excited about. And I'm really grateful that we all lived through it, because every song I sang felt like it was going to kill me. It was like, it was oppressive heat. And it was so oppressive that by the time the sun went down and we were playing maybe like at 7 and it wasn't like intense heat anymore, we thought, oh my gosh, this feels great. And then it was like probably maybe 119, 120.
Well, maybe 115, yeah. No, I always tell people when I'm forecasting the weather, and I talk about a 120 degree day, and we do get them, but I always remind people that 120 is exactly the temperature at which you take your steak off the grill if you want it rare. So
basically, that's how our skin is cooking at the time.
That is,
that's what
you have cooked yourself with so many other things.
I'm like a leisure suit. I'll be the last thing surviving.
The yellow and white plaid one?
My first marriage, I got married in a beige leisure suit. That marriage lasted 2.5 years, and I really suspect that's a lot of the reason why.
But if you wore one now, that would contrast so nicely with your taupe hair.
I'm going to do it. I'm bringing it back. I'm bringing back leisure suits.
Randy told us before the podcast that his hair's not white. It's taupe.
It's taupe.
Whatever. I mean,
jury's
yeah,
still out.
Sure.
You notice that silence that just kind of permeates?
I forgot I was mic'd up.
That was your inside voice that came out.
He's like, his hair's not fucking taupe.
Like, this fojito's getting to me. I'm getting really liberal with my comments now.
Well, let's get you a couple
Woo!
More. This has been absolutely fantastic.
It has.
Well, you guys are fun to hang out with. I don't know why we haven't done this sooner.
Yeah. I bet you really regret accident. Not showing up before, huh?
No, I'm good. This was the perfect time.
It was meant to be today.
Yes, yes.
Thanks for being here.
Well, I'm grateful that you guys hung in there with me, because I love that you guys are doing this, and I'm enjoying your podcast. I was listening to a couple of them as I pulled in the parking lot.
That's what I usually do.
That's two more than my wife has listened to. So
that's okay. I love seeing you at my gigs. So, you know, it's good.
Absolutely.
I love singing King of the Road with your band.
Yes, please. Anytime. You have an open invitation.
And
open
Dang
invitation.
Me. I think we should do Dang
I'm
Me.
I'm not sure that... Well, actually, they're a pretty good group. They would know Dang Me, but...
It's only two chords.
It's a little rangy for me.
Dang Me.
Dang Me's a little rangy for me.
But you could work it into the song, like, Dang Me. Yeah, it's okay.
Thanks for being here.
Lisa
this is really awesome.
Thank you so much. And you can find her work at the Joshua Tree Voice and, of course, with the Broken Hallelujahs, again, performing at Shanghai Reds every third.
Every third Thursday until it's just too hot for, you know, animals to want to live here. And then... every Wednesday at Casuelas Cafe until same thing, you know, until it's just ridiculously hot.
We'll be there.
All right, we're going to have to find you some indoor venues that you can play at.
That would be nice. This looks like a nice place, too, although the band would probably take up half of it.
It only seats 33, so if you bring the Broken Hallelujahs, you only have about 10 people who can sit in here. So.
But we'd be packed. There'd be a line out the door.
There would be.
No, yeah.
We should do a remote up at Joshua Tree.
We don't. We are on remote.
Your fans would love that. Oh my gosh, they sound so much better up there.
Well, the air is purer. Lisa Lynn Morgan, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Great. Well,
this has been another, and I think a terrific episode of Big Conversation.
You said global. Another terrific episode.
Okay. Said another and terrific.
This was a fantastic episode.
Great. It was terrific. It's always a pleasure to spend time with you. We thank our producer, John McMullen, who makes sure that this podcast gets churned out to every possible podcast platform so that everybody gets a chance
to shoot up and spit out.
And you can find us at bigconversationslittlebar.com. Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss one scintillating episode.
And buy some merch.
Or even the worst ones.
Buy some merch.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
We have merch.
Yeah.
There are mugs. There are t-shirts.
Speedos.
There are Speedos with Randy's picture on the back, which is weird. I didn't design it. So you can check it all out. Big conversation.
Mine just says Libar. The Speedo is pretty small.
It was a good episode.
See, if you got a band, you'd have a drummer going.
Just can't stick the landing. Thank you guys very much. We'll be back with another episode real soon.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar. Recorded on location at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, the center of the Coachella Valley universe. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. All episodes are available from BigConversationsLittleBar.com or from most major podcast portals, including Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Music.